Good morning. This morning, the talk, and thank you, worship leader. It's going to be on the unlimited states of mind. When I was working on this 2 weeks ago, reminded me of the children's storytelling. So I want to start with that. Lord Buddha says, what the Buddha points to with the four unlimited states of mind is not simply moral behavior, but a complete inner training of consciousness. And these are the four state of mind Buddha was saying. Each of us, if you are the seeker for truth, for enlightenment, this you need to work on. It needs to be part of us. Compassion, which may be in Hindu or Tibetan, is karuna. Tenderness or loving kindness, metta, metta. Gladness or sympathetic joy, mudita. And equanimity, which is upekkha. These are called unlimited because they are not meant to be restricted to a few people we like. They are meant to be cultivated toward all beings without exception. This universality is what makes them transformative. Because when we say all beings, we're not just talking humans now. We should have compassion to ourselves, towards each other, towards the, and we've talked about this before. And that's why it's transformative. If we can practice that, if we can make that part of who we are. When they are limited to my family, as we all say, my group, my spiritual community, or those who agree with me, they easily turn into attachment, favoritism. Well, that's a member of our community, so I'm going to do things for you. You stay behind. And eventually conflict. We see that in our politics in our country now. When they become unlimited, they dissolve the roots of suffering. Because when you're eating your own meal, and while you are eating, you are thinking of somebody who is starving, who doesn't have a meal. It might be in your neighborhood, it might be somebody you run. And if you put aside maybe one morsel of your, and then take it to them, that compassion, it allows that person, it elevates them above that particular suffering that they are going through, poverty or, lack. Each of these states directly counteracts a deep human tendency that causes pain. For example, compassion dissolves greed. Greed is the habit of grasping, of wanting more for oneself. Compassion turns the attention to outwards. When you sincerely feel the suffering of another, we're not saying, artificial thinking. When you sincerely feel the suffering of another, it becomes difficult to hoard, to exploit, or remain indifferent. When you look at the places of conflict of war, if there's compassion, there'll be no war between the Palestinians and the Israelis. There will be no war between Russia and Ukraine. Or in Sudan, you know. Compassion softens the heart so that fulfillment is no longer measured by what you possess, but by the well-being you contribute to. In this way, compassion is not weakness. It is a radical reorientation of what you value in life. Let me repeat that, because sometimes we overlook them. Compassion softens the heart so that fulfillment is no longer measured by what you and I possess. Because we always measure ourselves by, oh, my bank account, you know, the house I live in, the brand clothing, the car I drive, I have a yacht, and I have that. I'm sure if we ask those who have it, yeah, it might fulfill them for after a while. They get bored, won't they? People who measure themselves by what is material, you find that they still lack. Because we look at our country here, with all the billionaires, people should not be struggling to, you know, to pay their, to have their medication. When it's summer, to be able to have air conditioning, or when it's winter, to be able to provide heat. There are people who cannot afford it. And some, because they have to measure between taking their medication and their food. And this is supposed to be the greatest country in the world. It shouldn't be like that. And our politicians will actually look out for those who are in need of this. Now let's talk about the second one. Tenderness or loving kindness. It dissolves anger. Just like compassion dissolves greed. Anger thrives on separation. It is me versus you. When you cannot see the other person unless they do what you want, even if they are your bloodline, sometimes we have totally different views, and then it's us versus them. I've always wondered, and I've said this before, we claim this is America, this is our land, so anyone coming from other places, no, they are not welcome. Did America pay for this land? Did we create it here? It belongs to God, isn't it? And yeah, we separate, you know, this is ours. And so it doesn't matter whether other people are suffering, they are not welcome here. And if you think America is the only one doing it, then you have none, you don't know the rest of the world. It's the same thing. Tenderness, loving kindness dissolves anger. Anger thrives on separation. Me versus you. Loving kindness actively wishes well-being for others, even those who challenge or hurt us. Remember the story of the Samaritan that Jesus talked about? A Jewish man or a Hebrew who was, you know, with the armed robber, and another Hebrew passed by, they didn't do anything. But the Samaritan, who they don't see eye to eye, is the one that took care of. Whatever we wish for ourselves, we wish for others, and we actively pursue that way. This does not mean approving of harmful actions. Somebody is going to shoot you, and you say, oh, okay, I got to pretend that. No, you better protect yourself. But it means refusing to dehumanize people. I've always wondered, why do people want to hurt the dogs or the cats? We've heard stories. Or why do you want the cocks to be fighting, knowing that they will hurt each other, or dog fighting? We've heard stories. So what kind of spirit lives in those people? Why do you want to take another human being and enslave them so that you can make money? You prostitute them. When tenderness is cultivated, anger loses its fuel. You begin to see that most harmful behavior comes from ignorance, fear, and pain. Because some people feel, well, if I'm going through this, others should feel it. Well, others have their own thing too, you know. Tenderness reframes the other person not as an enemy, but another being struggling within their own limitations. That's why they say, put yourself in the other person's shoes, you know, before you judge them, and then you will find out. So from tenderness, we go to gladness, or what we call sympathetic joy, when you are joyful. It deserves suffering. Gladness or sympathetic joy is the capacity to rejoice in the happiness and success of others. I've always wondered why people are jealous of the other person. It doesn't even make sense to me. Because my experience is, when you are happy for others, for that they are thriving and all of that, you open the door for your own blessings to come in. So you rejoice when things are going well for them, even if you don't see eye to eye. Much of human suffering comes from comparison, envy, and the feeling that another's gain is our loss. No, it's not. There's enough in this universe for everyone to go home with and enjoy. Otherwise, when the rain falls, I mean, does it discriminate against anyone? The sun doesn't shine and discriminate. Gladness or joy cuts directly against this pattern that we don't have enough. Okay, I need to get mine now. When you feel genuine joy for another's good fortune, the mind becomes lighter. So actually, you are not doing them any favor. It is a selfish act on you, because now you allow yourself to bring in good things. You feel good about yourself. This joy is not dependent on personal achievement. It is spacious. You can't restrict it. It trains our heart to recognize abundance rather than scarcity. Equanimity. Sometimes that thing doesn't roll in my tongue, so I have to slow down. Equanimity dissolves discrimination and partiality. Equanimity is often misunderstood as indifference, but it is actually a deep steadiness of mind. It allows you to care without being destabilized by preferences, aversions, praise, or blame. There's one I'm going to quote directly from the Buddha thing that he says, and I love that about this. This is what uproots the habit of dividing the world into friends and enemies. when you are balanced. With equanimity, you can meet all situations with balance, clarity, and fairness. Because when you are not envy of somebody else, when you know, okay, I'm getting mine, you are getting yours. When you don't show the ugly side of humanity, where you are angry at someone, you hate them. When we practice equanimity, when it's part of us, we are no longer dragged around by emotional extremes. This is the ground of true peace. So these four qualities, let me repeat them again. Compassion dissolves greed. Tenderness dissolves anger. Joy or gladness dissolves suffering. And equanimity dissolves discrimination and partiality. So together, these four qualities form a complete psychology. They purify intention. What is your intention when you meet another person? What is your intention? Like that commercial, what is in your wallet? What is in your heart? So these four, they will purify your intention, your emotion, your perception and response. Instead of, we didn't say reaction, we say response. Because when somebody insults you, if you are not in that equanimity state, you will react. So it will turn into two fighting, bosa. But when you take a breath and say, okay, maybe this person is having a bad day, or whatever it is. And then you just say, didn't Jesus say, if they smack you here, turn the other? Then that's what Jesus meant. Then you don't react, you respond. You even silently bless them, that God may help them lift up whatever it is that is working them. But as the Buddha acknowledges, this training is not easy. See, that's why we, and there's a story that I put in there that you will see. Yeah, it's so easy to say it. Look, what do they say? Talk is cheap. Let's see what you got. The metaphors we shared are striking and honest. An unwholesome mind is like letters carved in stone. Deeply ingrained habits formed through years of repetition. A wholesome mind at first is like words written in water, easily disturbed, easily forgotten. You guys should pay attention to those metaphors. Unwholesome is written in stone. You see it. Even the weather can wipe it off. But the wholesome mind is like water. Have you tried to write letters in water? It shows and it's done. Well, I think we now have it on text. The text you sent and it dissolves right away, right? It disappears. This speaks to the reality of practice. We got to practice. Old patterns have momentum. Anger, greed, and fear arise automatically because they have been rehearsed for a lifetime. Kindness, patience and clarity must be consciously cultivated until they too become second nature. I look at myself now and compare myself to the 80s or 70s. Oh my God, it's a far cry. Somebody has grown up. Somebody has grown up. Thank God for that. The metaphor of tuning the harp string is especially powerful. Spiritual practice bear with me for a minute. Spiritual practice fails when we approach it with either extreme. That's why the metaphor of, you know, the strings. You have to tune it well. If it's too tight, it will break. If it's too loose, you can't make any sounds out of it. If the strings are too loose, we become complacent. We say, this is too hard. I don't want to meditate. It's just too hard. I don't want to do any mantra. Especially if we're going through challenges. Well, what has God done for me lately? Yeah. Or, well, I'll practice later. I remember Yogananda saying, in his early days, he would say, okay, yeah, I will meditate for 3 hours. And he keep postponing it. A year went by. And finally decided, this is not going anywhere. So then he started doing it. At one point, he said, okay, when he gets up, he'll go and take a shower, do all, then come meditate. And things may interfere between. So when he gets up, before he speaks to anyone, he meditates first and then go and take a shower. And I can relate to that big time. For our practice later and drift back, we drift back to old habit. If the strings are too tight, we become harsh with ourselves. We strive with ego, self-judgment, and impatience, turning practice into another form of suffering. So there has to be a middle way. We have to balance it up. The middle way is a wise, compassionate discipline, consistent effort without self-violence. Please pay attention to that. Self-violence. We're not even talking about what you are doing to the other person. Because if you cannot say anything good in you, are you going to say anything good in another person? Talk about we become our worst enemies. If we judge ourselves, then it will be easier to judge others. But if you give ourselves a break, okay, so you messed up. Whoop-de-doo. Life goes on. Clean up yourself. Do your best not to mess up again. Go on. If you keep doing that, then it'll be easier to have compassion for somebody else when the Uber driver didn't pick you up on time or he misses the, you know, it takes a longer road. Training the mind is like training a muscle. Steady, patient repetition over time reshapes what once felt impossible into what becomes natural. Now, I want to talk about the story of the prince. Then I'll give the breakdown. Once, there was a prince who was skillful in the use of the five weapons. One day he was returning home from his practice and met a monster whose skin was invulnerable. The monster started for him, but nothing daunted the prince. The prince shot an arrow at him, which fell harmless. Then he threw his spear, which failed to penetrate the thick skin of the monster. Then he drew a bar and a javelin, but they failed to hurt the monster. We know what a javelin is, isn't it? Then he used his sword, but the sword broke. The prince attacked the monster with his fist and feet, but to no purpose. He's like, oh, we're going to just die here today. Before you kill me, I'm going to fight. No more. You know. For the monster clutched him in his giant arms and held him fast. Then the prince tried to use his head, like giving a butt head as a weapon, but in vain. The monster just looked at him and said, it is useless for you to resist. I'm going to devour you. I'm going to eat you up for lunch and dinner. But the prince answered, in spite of all of that, the prince answered, you may think that I have used all my weapons and I'm helpless, but I still have one weapon left. If you devour me, I will destroy you from the inside of your stomach. The courage of the prince disturbed the monster so much. And he asked, "How can you do that?" The prince replied, "By the power of the truth." Then the monster said, "Hmm?" Then the monster released him and begged for his instructions in the truth. Well, because he doesn't want to be destroyed. So if he knows all the answers, then he can, you know. The teaching of this story is to encourage us as disciples, as children of God, to persevere in our efforts and to be undaunted in the face of many setbacks. And definitely, there are setbacks, aren't there? So this is my breakdown. With the help of my best friend, AI. The story of the prince and the monster illustrates the inner dimension of spiritual courage. The monster with invulnerable skin symbolizes the seemingly unbeatable forces within us. Let us not forget that. Our deeply rooted fear, craving, hatred, ignorance, envy, you go on and on. The prince's weapons, arrows, spear, sword, fist, represent the ordinary strategies we use to overcome our problems. Willpower, we argue with ourselves, you know, the habit, suppression, aggression, even self-attack. You are not good. That's why you can't make anything of yourself. All of these fail against deeply entrenched patterns. Those of us who have habits, we know what that is like, right? But the prince's final weapon is truth. This suggests that awakening does not come from fighting the mind, but from seeing clearly. We shouldn't forget, Lord Buddha talked about these four things for someone who wants to be enlightened. And to be enlightened means you have to be awakened. And awakening does not come from fighting the mind, but from seeing clearly. Isn't that what we talked about in meditation? Just observe the thoughts as they come. Don't engage them. But if you see the one you like, embrace it. But don't get attached to it either. You are sitting there and your mind is going to the mall. It's going to, you know, let it come, let it go. See it clearly. Truth here is not mere belief. It is insight into the nature of suffering, the impermanence, and the self. Because nothing is permanent, not this world. If we know that, we won't be afraid of all this other stuff. When ignorance is exposed by understanding, the monster, remember the monster, loses his power. The very force that seemed to threaten to devour us becomes transformed through awareness. So even if you're afraid, shaking in your boots, just open your eyes. Ask yourself, why am I shaking in my boots? Why am I so worried about tomorrow? Let me just enjoy today. Tomorrow will take care of it. If you can see your fear, if you can see why you hate, why you are jealous, oh, then you will find that it doesn't. It's as simple as that, but you have to observe it. I'll give a quick anecdote here. Sometimes the other power, the other people, you know, they come and terrorize me when I'm meditating or sleeping. And I'm calling on Jesus, okay. One day I'm just saying, what the heck? I'm tired of being threatened. Then I begin to observe. And I said, what are you going to do? They were so surprised, and I was so shocked beyond imagination that was the simple answer to the bullies who have been bullying me spiritually. when you find out, no, they don't have that power. They have the power because you let them. You are afraid. When you stand, it's like, okay. I never seen it. And once in a while, they still show up. And I say, really? I thought we've worked this out. Instead of me, reading Psalm 91, calling on Archangel Michael, and Jesus is going to kick your butt. No, just like, look, we're not doing that today. I don't have time for you. You need to go away. Yeah, go somewhere. And don't bully others. Just go eat something. The very force that seemed to threaten to devour us becomes transformed through awareness. This story of the master and the prince also emphasizes perseverance. Remember, he did everything, and finally the monster said, "Well, you eat me, I'm going to do something to you." He persevered, he didn't run, he didn't give up, because if he had given up, the monster would have eaten him. And we've heard stories of Lord Krishna and another disciple, something like that. The prince does not give up after repeated failure. He continues to meet the challenge with courage and creativity. This is essential for the path of inner training. Setbacks are not signs of failure. They are part of the process. Each relapse into anger, greed, or confusion becomes material for learning. Anytime you think you're working on this habit and it comes back, don't give up. Over time, the practitioner develops confidence, not because they never fall, but because they learn how to stand back up with clarity and humility. Ultimately, what these teachings offer is a realistic, compassionate view of spiritual growth. That's why Lord Buddha said that. If you seek enlightenment, this is what you need. This is how to go about it. Enlightenment is not a sudden escape from being human. It is the gradual refinement of how we meet our humanity. If you think enlightenment is not going to happen overnight, it's not. Every little step counts, and you're going to need to progress. The four unlimited states of mind are not abstract ideals. We can relate to them, can't we? They are practical disciplines for transforming relationships, inner dialogue, and daily choices. Through steady practice, what is written in water becomes slowly inscribed in the heart. And as this happens, the mind becomes less a battlefield and more a field of understanding, balance, and quiet joy. Now I'm going to end that with one last expression. Buddha says, he who is influenced by his likes and dislikes cannot rightly understand the significance of circumstances and tends to be overcome by them. He who is free from attachments rightly understands circumstances, and to him or her, all things become new and significant. Happiness follows sorrow. Sorrow follows happiness. But when one no longer discriminates between happiness and sorrow, a good deed and a bad deed, one is able to realize freedom. To worry in anticipation or to cherish regret for the past is like the reeds that are cut and wither away. The secret of health for both mind and body is not to mourn for the past, not to worry about the future, or not to anticipate troubles, but to live wisely and earnestly for the present. Do not dwell in the past. Do not dream of the future. Concentrate the mind on the present moment. And then we're on our way to enlightenment and freedom. May we be so blessed. Amen.